Hey, welcome back. My name is Sven Lütteken. I'll be moderating this panel. Let me just begin by simply reading the description of this panel in the program. That way we'll all know what it is that we're supposed to discuss here. It says in the program, the ReadyMate was originally conceived by Marcel Duchamp as a strategy that would run counter to the logic of the market and jeopardize any economic value. However, the idea of a transfer from the quotidian into an art context has turned into a paradigm for value creation. The ready-made has become the favorite subject of speculators, speculators of capital, as well as speculators of theory. End of quote. Now, indeed, as we've already heard, late in his life, Duchamp was indeed very critical of art as financial speculation, and he evinced a kind of bohemian nostalgia for the time when life used to be cheap, when art was not a success story, when the artist hadn't become fully integrated into the culture industry yet. We might say nostalgia for a time of formal subsumption rather than real subsumption. However, let us not forget that the ready-made came about during the First World War when one European country after another abandoned the gold standard and money became fiat money. And in some of his works from the late 1910s and early to mid-1920s, Duchamp also responded to the instability of the market, to the instability of value itself. We can think here, for instance, of Zank Czech from 1919, the fake check that he created to pay his dentist with, or indeed Monte Carlo bond from 1924, which is listed as an imitated rectified ready-made in the catalogue raisonné, and which was indeed an edition of bonds that Duchamp sold to his friends, to acquaintances, who would then have the right to part of the profit, to a share in the profits that he would make whilst gambling in Monte Carlo on the roulette. And the Little Review in the United States, an important avant-garde magazine, wrote about this Monte Carlo bond, I quote, "If anyone is in the business of buying art curiosities as an investment, there is a chance to invest in a perfect masterpiece. Marcel's signature alone is worth much more than the 500 francs asked for the share." So, 1924. However, this was, of course, something that was above all aimed at quite literally buying Duchamp time. So it wasn't necessarily about making huge profits, and indeed, as a money-making venture in Monte Carlo on the roulette wheel, it was a bust. But it was indeed about buying time, about it was one of a number of pieces, one of a number of strategies that Duchamp employed to enable his, shall we say, lifestyle, his practice, as something that was nearly invisible to the art world at large and to the outside world, but that was sustainable, we might say. It was part of a certain ecology, and he was able to bide his time. Now, Duchamp also had a somewhat solipsistic theory, which he defended quite seriously, to the effect that any real artwork only has a lifespan of some 20 years. He said this time and again, an artwork is alive for 20 years or so, then it becomes part of art history. You know, when it's successful, if it's canonized, it becomes art history and it's dead. It's no longer living art. This, we might say, is a kind of bohemian avant-garde understanding of the relation between art and art history. So we have living art on the one hand and then museified, canonized art history on the other hand. Yeah? Once the curators become involved, basically you know that the art is dead. So in that sense, Duchamp was far from inconsistent when, for instance, he began to work on his self-canonization in the mid to late 1930s with the Boîte en Valise, or when he embraced the uses to which the ready-made was put around 1960 and throughout the 1960s in the context of Nouveau Realisme and so on. And when he agreed to have Arthur Schwarz produce editions of his ready-mades, he entered what he called his sex maniac phase. He said yes to everything. But the art, at least the art of circa 1950, 1917, was by that time, according to his own, let's say, ideology, dead, which also meant that it was open to constant reappropriation. and he was not one to resist any particular reappropriation. It was all good as far as he was concerned. Now, so many years later, in the year 2017, we may well wonder, and this issue has already been raised a couple of times, what, if any, contemporary relevance and potentiality we see in the ready-made principle. In some cases, we can discern a sort of turn for the worse that the image, that the reputation of the ready-made has taken. The ready-made seems to have become a bad object for some, because it is indeed associated with and seen as the engine of a culture of speculation in the financial, perhaps more so than in the theoretical sense. So Tanya Bugera has put Fountain back in the bathroom as a functioning urinal, as a kind of manifesto of her notion of arte util, of useful art, of art that is something else than an investment and that has other uses, different uses. Of course, it's still visible as indeed a detourned ready-made. So the Duchampian gesture isn't erased. It is negated, we might say, but there is no full erasure. It is still not quite a normal functioning urinal. It is Fountain kind of returned to a use that Duchamp's gesture negated to begin with. Perhaps on a more sophisticated level, we could also think here of the aforementioned Museum of Modern Art. I think Inka Arns already mentioned this project, this praxis by the artist who must not be named, but who often uses the name of Walter Benjamin for his theoretical statements. And this Walter Benjamin has argued that when antique sculptures were shown at the Belvedere during the Renaissance in the 16th century, they were not just the first objects of art, but they were actually the first ready-mades, because they had not been produced for exhibition purposes in this early museum context. They were appropriated by the Belvedere as basically the fountainhead of modern museological practices. And here's an installation shot of an exhibition by the Museum of American Art with indeed paintings depicting some of the antiques shown and still to this day shown at the Vatican. The Vatican, which of course also is hoarding, as Carter Atia, I believe, has told us, a huge collection of African artifacts from the colonial era. So yeah, in both in the case of both Tanya Bugera and the Museum of American Art, we might say that there's a desire to reverse the ready-made principle in a very fundamental sense. Walter Benjamin, the Museum of American Art, also argues that museums now need to be transformed to no longer function as storage facilities for fetishes, for commodity fetishes, for ready-mades and other fetishized objects. They should be turned into different kinds of institutions that may indeed very well collect artifacts, but those artifacts should indeed function differently, and they should no longer be objects of art. They should no longer be ready-mades in that sense. Now, these are some thoughts that may perhaps also help us during the discussion. The questions, or the set of questions that we'll be dealing with in this panel, above all, revolve precisely about the contemporaneity, the anachronistic contemporaneity of Duchamp, of the ready-made in today's financialized art world. So did Duchamp indeed, with his de-skilled act, turn the work into something akin to a financial asset? Did he help to create the conditions for today's art world? And if so, are there ways of once again rereading the ready-made, once again recognizing an as yet untapped potentiality in the ready-made? Can it still offer us conceptual tools, aesthetic strategies? Our three speakers will attack this cluster of questions in various ways, discussing issues having to do with immaterial labor, dead labor, branding strategies, And so on. We will have three speakers who are all, I would like to stress, respondents, so we don't necessarily adhere to this distinction between artistic statements and then, you know, the art historians or the theorists who are the respondents. We have one artist and we have art historians slash critics slash theorists, but they are all respondents to the overall problematic of this panel. And we begin with Sebastian Egenhofer, who teaches, who's a professor at the University of Vienna. Then we proceed with Isabel Graf, who's among many other things, a publisher of Texte zur Kunst. And then we top it off with Simon Denny, a Berlin-based artist whose work I'm sure you all know, and if not, you will encounter it today. So Sebastian, the floor is yours.